Support for this podcast comes from San Francisco International Airport. At SFO, you can discover award-winning flavors and unique shops all before takeoff. Learn more about what's at SFO at flysfo.com.
Hey, it's Glenn Washington from Snap Judgment. And if you love what you're hearing, and I know you love what you're hearing, please consider becoming a KQED member. Get special access to cool events, behind-the-scenes footage, and so much more. Plus, you'll sleep better at night knowing you did your part for the community you depend upon. It's in you. Please be in it. Visit donate.kqed.org/podcasts to sign up now. That's podcast with an S. Thanks.
From KQED.
Oh, is that? Oh, that's a fake background. That's a bookstore.
No, it's my real office.
Is it really?
Yeah.
This is Political Breakdown from KQED in San Francisco. I'm Scott Schaefer. Well, it's a big week for Donald Trump, and he'll be stuck in a Manhattan courtroom for most of it. The first of several pending trials against the former president got underway in New York today, a case where prosecutors say Trump engaged in a conspiracy to cover up a sex scandal with adult film star Stormy Daniels in order to get elected president in 2016. Now, Trump faces dozens of felony charges and the possibility of jail time, and the trial comes just days before the U.S. Supreme Court considers the limits of presidential immunity as he faces federal charges over his involvement in the January 6th uprising at the Capitol and charges in another case over his handling of national security documents at his home in Florida. Here to discuss all this is Melissa Murray, law professor at New York University, and before joining the faculty at NYU, by the way, she taught at UC Berkeley's Law School. Melissa Murray, thank you so much for joining us on what is clearly a pretty historic day and week in the courts.
Oh, it's a big week in the courts. It's great to be here, Scott.
Professor Murray, let me begin by asking you for the big picture. What is the main thrust of this case? What's at stake legally?
So, as you know, I'm the author of this book, The Trump Indictments, with my colleague, Andrew Weissman. And so we've collected the indictments and we've tried to explain it. And this one was the one that really vexed us the most because of all of the different criminal cases against Donald Trump. This one feels the most small bore. But in fact, once you dig into the indictment and you sort of look under the hood, there's a lot there. So this has been called the hush money case, but really it is about the falsification of business records, which is a misdemeanor crime in New York, for the purpose, according to prosecutors, of engaging in what amounts to election fraud or tax fraud. And that's what sort of casts it up to a felony. So it's about trying to take this affair, this alleged affair with adult film star Stormy Daniels, and hide it from the voting public and Mr. Trump's wife so that it doesn't come out and damage his prospects in the 2016 election. So if you think about it in tandem with the January 6th election interference case, this is sort of an amuse-bouche of election interference.
A little appetizer, I guess.
A little bit.
But there are many legal experts say that this is really less important than the cases that Jack Smith, the special counsel, is bringing in the January 6th case and the Mar-a-Lago case with the documents. Do you agree with that in terms of the significance of the allegations and the severity of the alleged crimes?
So again, I think this is only small bore in comparison with the other three indictments, which, as you note, are really enormous and consequential. So two of them, the Georgia indictment and the Jack Smith January 6th election interference indictment, are about the question of election interference, trying to stop the peaceful transition of power, which is enormous. And of course, the Mar-a-Lago case is about the retention of the most sensitive classified information. So it has enormous consequences for national security. I think it's only in that landscape that this looks a little poo-poo by comparison. Because in fact, if you look at this indictment, this is not simply about paying your fixer to pay your alleged paramour in order to keep her story to herself. It also engages and enlists the help of the media. And so if you think about the media being one of the most essential checks on the president, the idea that the press will surface things that the electorate needs to understand, the idea that the media is a big part of covering this up makes it, I think, a little more profound, a little less, just tawdry and salacious and more of an election interference case. So, again, you've got to look at the whole sweep of this.
Well, and first up today as the witness for the prosecution was David Pecker, publisher of the National Enquirer, which is, let's face it, kind of a gossipy, trashy tabloid. What is the significance of how the prosecution is framing what happened here, which is basically kind of a what Pecker described as checkbook journalism, but others describe as kind of you pay somebody to kill the story.
Yeah, what a day for David Pecker, who's normally about the headlines, not the headline himself. So he, as you say, is the CEO of the National Enquirer. And say what you will about the National Enquirer, quite a lot of Americans do get their news or at least read and consume the National Enquirer. So it is a media source. And what's really notable here is that David Pecker is essentially noting the way in which during his time and his tenure as CEO of the National Enquirer, the organization repeatedly caught and killed particular stories. So this sort of came out in the context of Harvey Weinstein a couple of years ago. But the idea here is that someone comes to you with a quite salacious story about a public figure and you purchase the rights to that story. They think that you are going to publish the story, but in fact, you purchase the rights, you make them sign a non-disclosure agreement, and then you never run the story. And this is especially important for the prosecution because the whole scheme that they are trying to present to the jury is that the knowledge of Donald Trump's alleged affairs with these individuals, Stormy Daniels being the principal one, cannot come out to the voting public, especially in the aftermath of the Access Hollywood tape in October 2016. And so these catch and kill schemes become part of the way the Enquirer works to help Donald Trump.
In its oral arguments, or his opening statements, I should say, today, the Trump's attorney said to the jury, quote, "I have a spoiler alert. There's nothing wrong with trying to influence an election. It's called democracy." What's missing from that characterization of what's being alleged here?
So it's true. There's nothing wrong with trying to influence the voters, to present your best face to the voters. I think where it becomes a problem is really in the cover-up, the fact that you are falsifying business records in violation of state law and potentially committing tax fraud, because one of the things that the prosecution alleges in the indictment, and I think will become a bigger part of its case in chief, is that Michael Cohen, one, took out a home equity loan in order to provide these payments to Stormy Daniels. And then because he was falsifying business records and putting this down as payments for legal services, it was being taxed as income. So Donald Trump, in reimbursing him, actually had to gross it up, and that becomes tax fraud. So it's not necessarily the act, it's the cover up, I think.
You mentioned Trump's former attorney, Michael Cohen, who's going to be a star witness for the prosecution here. He's not an ideal witness, is he? Because he has, spent some time, I think, in jail himself. Describe how much of a problem, if any, that is for the prosecution.
Well, he's got a lot of baggage, maybe more baggage than the first class passenger on the Titanic. So there's a lot for the prosecution to have to deal with here and a lot for the defense to work with. But that's not always unusual. There are lots of prosecutions where the individuals that you're relying on to provide the most important evidence in your case are individuals who don't come to the court with clean hands. But again, this is an important opportunity and an opening for the defense to really impeach Michael Cohen's credibility. And Cohen himself has done some things that are clearly quite impeachable. He has admitted to perjury, or if he hasn't admitted to perjury, he's opened the door that perhaps he has done things that would be in the range of perjury or at least lying before the court in other contexts. The defense is going to make a lot of that. And I think what the prosecution has already made clear their intent is that Michael Cohen is not the crux of their case in chief. He's a big part of it, certainly, but everything that Michael Cohen is going to say today, they seem to suggest, would be corroborated by other witnesses who are perhaps less encumbered by so much baggage.
And then quickly, if you could, how likely is Trump to take the stand?
Well, he said that he's going to take the stand, but as you know, he doesn't have to here. In fact, he actually doesn't have to do anything but sit there and watch the prosecution mess up, because the entire burden in a criminal case is on the government here, the New York DA, to prove all of the crimes that Donald Trump has been charged with beyond a reasonable doubt. So he shouldn't have to, and he probably should not do that.
All right, we're going to take a short break. And when we return, more of our conversation with NYU law professor Melissa Murray, and a look ahead to Thursday's oral arguments as well at the U.S. Supreme Court over presidential immunity and how it relates to other federal charges against Trump. You're listening to Political Breakdown. I'm Scott Schaefer. We'll be right back.
Hi, I'm Sasha Coca, host of the California Report magazine. Every week, we bring you stories about what connects us in the giant, diverse Golden State. Because what happens in California changes the world.
I love this place. We were once seen as like the place to be, California. The land of milk and honey. That's where you go to Sunshine State. But we just have challenges right now.
KQED's California Report magazine. New episodes drop every Friday, wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey there, this is Brittany Luce from NPR's It's Been a Minute. KQED's podcasts like The Bay, Bay Curious, Mind Shift, Right Nowish, and more all tell the stories of the Bay and beyond with reliable, human-centered journalism. They aim to inspire, make you think, entertain, and expand your understanding of the place you call home. Here's how you can support podcasting at KQED.
Showing your support is easy, and you can join Brittany in supporting KQED Podcast too at donate.kqed.org/podcast. That's donate.kqed.org/podcast.
And welcome back to Political Breakdown. I'm Scott Schaefer. My guest today is Melissa Murray. She teaches law at NYU in the city where the trial over Donald Trump's hush money payments to adult film star Stormy Daniels got underway today. By the way, her book is titled The Trump Indictments. Check that out as well. Before we went to the break, Professor Murray, we were talking about whether or not Donald Trump might testify. And there was a ruling today before opening arguments that the judge made that other cases, many other cases involving Trump and his violation of the gag order and so on, could be brought up by the prosecution. What impact do you think that could have on either Trump's likeliness, the likelihood that he will, you know, get on the stand? Because that would seem to open him up for a whole lot of other things he might not want to talk about.
Yeah, this is a really important ruling in this so-called Sandoval hearing that the court had this morning. And the judge, Judge Merchan, has allowed the prosecution to bring in Trump's statements from these other trials. He was sworn under oath in those other trials, which are civil trials. But that information can be brought in and can be used to impeach his statement. So again, this is someone who is kind of a bombastic figure. And I think what the prosecution is hoping is that these other statements, if they can be brought in and can be used against him, they can sort of show inconsistencies in his story, which will damage his credibility with the jury in this particular trial. So it's a real big win for the prosecution. And I think it will color whether or not the defense allows their client to take the stand in his own defense.
Which, you know, sitting there and not talking must be the hardest part of all for Donald Trump, I would imagine. He doesn't look happy.
Or not sleeping, as it seems to be. Apparently, he has rested his eyes quite frequently during the course of this. Not surprising.
Yeah. Well, you know, Trump and his attorneys say this is all political, that the DA, Alvin Bragg, the Manhattan DA, is a Democrat, and this is all politically motivated. Do you think that if Trump were just businessman Trump, you know, and he hadn't run for president and he hadn't become president, would this even have seen the light of day?
It's a really good question. It's one that Andrew Weissman and I talk about in our book, The Trump Indictments. We try to distinguish between a truly righteous prosecution and what's known as a show trial. And we talk about this across all four of the indictments, particularly Mar-a-Lago, where, you know, as we note, it's quite common for individuals who are retaining classified information to do jail time, and certainly someone who has been accused of having so much classified information. This particular trial, I think, raises the most questions, not because the facts aren't interesting or because the charges aren't significant. They are. And as we note in the introduction to the book, this is something, this crime, falsification of business records, that Alvin Bragg has shown is something that New Yorkers are repeatedly and routinely prosecuted for. So this isn't a case of selective prosecution. I think what makes the difference here and what raises eyebrows is that it's ordinarily the case that that New Yorkers are prosecuted under this misdemeanor charge, just the falsification of business records. It's when that charge is then bootstrapped to another crime that raises it to a felony, you see less of that. And so I think that is an open question. It does seem here that this falsification of business records was undertaken in the furtherance of these other crimes, but it's not clear that this is always routinely prosecuted as such in New York.
And just real quickly before we move on, you know, the judge in this case has placed a gag order on Trump. I'm wondering, you know, he's repeatedly violated that. Is there anything Trump could do, deliberately or otherwise, that would in some way jeopardize this case and force a mistrial?
Oh, that's a great question. I think the bigger question is there anything Donald Trump could do that would prompt Judge Merchan to hold him in contempt of court, like with regard to the gag order? So far, very few judges have taken what seems like a nuclear option with him, sort of holding him criminally liable for the statements that he made. But they have tried finding him. That sort of worked a little bit toward the end in the civil trial, the civil fraud trial. But I think very few judges are willing to make a martyr of Donald Trump. And again, I think the prospect of criminal contempt would allow Donald Trump to go back to his followers and talk about how he's being selectively targeted. And I think very few people want to do that.
So on Thursday, the U.S. Supreme Court is going to hear oral arguments on whether presidential immunity shields Trump, not in this case, but from the other federal charges he's facing over January 6th and the election attempt to subvert the election results, as well as the national security documents case in Florida. What jumps out at you in this case? Because one of the things that people have been talking about since the high court decided to even take this up is the schedule. Why are they taking so long? You know, the prosecution, of course, wants this done quickly, and they don't seem to be on a fast track.
No, this is the one that really sort of sticks in my craw. And it's not just that the prosecution wants to resolve the issue of immunity expeditiously. Donald Trump should want to resolve the question of immunity expeditiously as well. I mean, if you are a criminal defendant and you believe righteously that you are immune from criminal prosecution, you don't want another day to go by before that is resolved in your favor or just resolved generally. If you are genuinely immune from criminal liability, you want to know this and you want it decided quickly. The fact that the Supreme Court scheduled this oral argument for April 25th, the fact that they refused Jack Smith's offer to bring this case up and to skip the intermediate appellate court and just have the court decide this was made back in December, is really unusual. And the fact that it's now slated for the last day of the court's oral argument, the oral argument part of the term, is really significant. Because the bottom line is, I can't imagine a world in which the United States Supreme Court decides that a sitting president or a former president is absolutely immune from any kind of criminal liability for his actions. That is absolutely inconsistent with constitutional design and with the original intent of the framers. Maybe they tinker with it at the edges, but cannot imagine that that would be the case. So the idea that we're going to see something unusual here, I think we're actually going to see the court affirm, for the most part, what the lower court, the DC Circuit, did. But the fact that they have waited until April 25th, and the fact that we may not get a decision on this case until sometime later, maybe even June, means that regardless of what they ultimately decide, they've effectively immunized Donald Trump from this particular criminal prosecution. And that's the January 6th election interference case and possibly the Mar-a-Lago case as well. And so they've given him de facto immunity simply by letting the clock run on this. And so I think this is going to be an academic exercise ultimately. And the bottom line is we probably won't see a trial on those two federal cases.
I guess that only really works, though, if Donald Trump wins in November, right? Because if he loses, I mean, I would assume Jack Smith and under President Biden, the Department of Justice would continue as long as it takes.
That is true. That is certainly true. Again, we probably would not But I think the real question is, we probably would have to stop in both cases for some period of time before the election. I think just to avoid the appearance that the trials are influencing the election in some way. And then if he wins the election, obviously he can kill these with his new Department of Justice. If he doesn't, then, you know, there's room for Jack Smith or to resume both of these criminal prosecutions going forward. But the fact of the matter is, the question of January 6th goes to this question of the peaceful transition of power. That seems to be a relevant question that the electorate has a right to know the answer to. And a jury trial is the way that we determine disputed facts in our system. And the Supreme Court essentially has made it impossible for that to happen.
Before I let you go, I do want to ask you about something the court took up today, the Supreme Court, and that's the Grants Pass case. They heard arguments. This has to do with Grants Pass, Oregon. And it's a question, among other things, about how far local government can go in dealing with homelessness and encampments. And, you know, many are saying it's the biggest homeless case in decades. Big implications for states like California, of course. Over 2 hours of oral arguments today. Very interesting. A lot of debate, a lot of hypotheticals raised by the justices. What stood out for you?
Well, what stood out for me is that it seems like there's a 6-3 supermajority on the Supreme Court that seems to believe that this is something for local government to resolve, that this is not a decision that the court should be involved with legislating, that this is a public policy question, and it's within the police power of municipalities and states to make these decisions for themselves. And what was also sort of interesting, and, you know, and I say this understanding fully the scope of the problem. You know, I lived in Oakland for 12 years and saw the proliferation of the houselessness problem in Oakland. And I worked at UC Berkeley, where People's Park really did become not only a problem for the dignity of unhoused persons, but also a public health issue in many respects. So I see both sides of it quite clearly. There really did seem to be an empathy gap among some of the justices, like this idea that these are people. And there really was this sort of weird discussion where we were trying to figure out, like, is homelessness a status or is it conduct? And, you know, this goes back to a case from the 60s, Robinson versus the United States, where the court determined that while you can criminalize conduct, you cannot criminalize a status. Like, you cannot criminalize someone for being an addict, even if you can criminalize drug use. And so this was sort of the question at issue in Grants Pass today. Like, is it the act of sleeping in public that you are criminalizing, or is this really about criminalizing being unhoused? And again, the empathy gap was really apparent among some of the justices.
And the liberal justice, Justice Sotomayor, for example, said she likes to take a blanket to the beach or to the park and watch the stars, but that no one in Grants Pass who wasn't homeless was getting arrested or cited or fined, right? So it was really selectively implemented. That's part of this, too.
Well, selectively implemented and a way for localities to drive the homeless population out of their jurisdiction and into others. So it sort of raises questions like, this is a displacement problem, ultimately. Like, they will leave Grants Pass because of this law, but then they will go to a neighboring town. And so does that town respond in kind by passing the similar kind of law? And, like, ultimately, the real question, and this was sort of skirted at during the oral argument, is we really have an affordable housing crisis, and this is criminalizing a problem that's not going to go away because of the affordable housing crisis.
Very interesting. We should hear that one decided by the end of June, as all of them will be. Very interesting, and great to talk to you again. I haven't talked to you in quite a while since you left California, I think. But
it's great to talk to you, Scott. I miss the Golden State.
Oh, well, the Golden State misses you as well. Thank you so much. That's Melissa Murray, professor of law at NYU, also co-author of The Trump Indictments. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And that is a wrap for Monday, April 22nd. Political Breakdown is a production of KQED. Our engineer is Phil Mueller. Our producer is Juan Carlos Lara. I'm Scott Schaefer. Thank you so much for listening.
Hi there. I'm Randa Abdel-Fattah from Throughline. If you're listening to this podcast, you know that KQED produces exceptional storytelling that keeps you informed, inspired, and entertained. Their podcasts cover issues from your neighborhood to the entire country and everything in between. Support this work today.
You can help us continue to bring quality podcasts to your ears. Just head to donate.kqed.org/podcast. That's donate.kqed.org/podcast.